good morning. Actually, good afternoon. Well, I'm not too sure about that clock. It's one or the other. We are very pleased that everybody is here this morning and all had a good rest last night. The thing that maybe was missing yesterday that is very valuable, almost essential in a situation like we experienced yesterday, is to have a group debriefing session. Is where everybody can get together and talk about what happened. Because none of us could have expected what happened. None of us foresaw what happened yesterday. But I dare say it may take some time before we forget it, if ever. And if you think about some of the things that happened, I would first of all like to say to some things that maybe help you understand what actually took place, because when I went home last night, I went immediately to sleep. That's my usual way. I just fall in bed and go to sleep. But then I wake up about 1 o'clock and that's it. Then you go, that's when you debrief. Then you go through everything and you think it all through, and what could I have done that I didn't do, and why did I do that when I shouldn't have. All those things are the things that you go through. And I thought last night about some things which I thought maybe we'd just take a couple minutes at the head of this talk to discuss, because I didn't enjoy that. That wasn't something I would consider enjoyable. It was totally unexpected to have someone, like, I don't mean about the day or speaking. It was the interruption that we had that I'm thinking about, and that's probably what most people will remember about that day. I don't think you ever achieve anything by hollering. It's not what I do around the house. I don't settle things by that. It's not the loudest voice that wins. And it's been about 20 or 30 years since I've ever had an experience like that, an open-air speaking, where someone challenges you as we were challenged yesterday. But I think you want to just consider what was at stake yesterday. Like, we did our homework. We had a permit to speak in the park, exactly appended to the chart. Anyone could have seen that. But the young man that came up to challenge us did not feel we had a permit to speak in the park. And he wasn't talking about a permit from the governing people. He was talking about a permit from God to speak about God's word in public. He denied us that. Because he said, you've got to believe in the Trinity before you're allowed to speak on God's behalf. And I'm not even too sure where it may have ended had we proceeded down that path with him. Now, that's classic. That's going back a few hundred years. If it was a few hundred years ago, there might be a few brethren in jail today. They wouldn't be here. Because we would be doing something against the institution. We might have got a permit to speak from the local authorities, but we never got it from the church. And the church took exception to what we were saying because we wouldn't talk about the Trinity. We wouldn't confess that we believed in the Trinity. And you know, if you've read some of the records of people who spoke up on God's behalf, that was a crime for which you'd be imprisoned, could be tortured, or you could be dead this morning. Now, that's an interesting thing, because I don't think I've ever encountered such a classic clash between the church as an institution. You have no right to be here speaking, period, because you will not believe in the Trinity. I don't think I've ever had anybody challenge us like that. And whether the young man was sincere, I think he was. And I think it may have been that no one ever did that in his park right across probably from his church. No one ever came there to speak about something that wasn't, first of all, Catholic. You can see in that how different this world is outside these walls. Like, we can say what we like in these walls. We do it up in Canada all the time. But when you get outside these walls, it's a different situation. And I dare say if you ever really want to, impact upon the average person, you've got to get outside the walls where we can impact upon people who need to know what we had to say, even though it might be very difficult for them and for us to make that communication. I just thought again about the Apostle Paul, and we won't take the time to go up those verses, but in Acts 18 and 19, if we had had two or three other people as vocal as that young man was, we would have had to leave. Because you would never have got a word in. You couldn't say anything. The idea was to shout us down. That's the tactic of when you don't want a person to speak and you don't like what they're saying. Well, the apostles got run out of town from time to time, where people recognize, as long as we can say, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," loud enough and long enough, they've got nothing to say. And we can raise the crowd up so the crowd would throw them out of town. That's the way it used to be. And I thought that was really excellent in the sense that you could see we have no communion with that belief. There's no communion between light and dark. We have no fellowship between people who claim that and ourselves. And it was a good example of where we as Christadelphians are in terms of the world around us. We are so far away from the average church member out there that we never get the sight of that within walls. We have to go outside to see it. And it's not a reason to be silent. It's a reason to speak up all the more. When the Apostle Paul went into the synagogue and the people raised against him such a commotion that he had to leave, he went to the place next door and he kept on going. Like, it's not a reason ever to shut down. It's a reason to continue, but you should learn to expect this when people understand what we have to say. So that's an experience I won't forget, and I feel a lot closer to brethren here that they were down there talking, because that's what I think fellowship is. There's a word in the Greek that you wouldn't really discover this idea of fellowship unless you look through the Greek and see this word, which is spelled in the English S-U-N, but it is pronounced soon. And if you were looking at the word fellow prisoner or fellow servant, that's the use of this word. And it is used an enormous amount of times in the New Testament. But it's also always giving you where fellowship really is. Can't you imagine people having fellowship because they were prisoners together? People having fellowship because you went out and you spoke together and maybe what was a hostile audience? It's doing things together that binds people together. That's fellowship. It's not just coming here to worship. That's fellowship too, because we do it together. But it's a huge area. And the Bible speaks of this from time to time when it uses that word. And I just think that's one of the most enjoyable things. One of the ideas that we would like to see is that these sort of days continue, and that we're able to get other people involved in them. Now, thou shalt not covet. This is a huge study. One time I gave this set of talks, it took me 6 hours. So there's six separate talks to go through all the various aspects of this idea, thou shalt not covet. It's huge in the sense that we are largely unprepared for it. Don't know what's happening here, Sean. It looks like I'm frozen up. Anyway, we'll carry on because there's a couple things that I'd like you to see. If you go back to Exodus chapter 20, you can see it very much in the first account of the Ten Commandments. Well, that was a little diversion of thought in case this wouldn't come up, but if it comes up, I just want to, first of all, acquaint you a little bit with what covetousness is, because if you don't have some feel for this, the first part of the lesson sort of it doesn't have enough depth to it for you to understand where we're going with this. So here's a few little things just to help us put a parameter and a little handle on this idea. Most of us would agree that we live in a very covetous age. We live by a huge Costco store, and it is just busy all the time. Like, there's just people coming and going. I can't imagine how any place could be so, you know, so busy in terms of stores all around it selling basically the same thing, but Costco excels them all, it seems to me. So we do live in a very covetous age. We go down to Costco, we want one, we buy 15 because they're cheaper per unit. And that's the spirit of it. The spiritual problems associated with covetousness are hardly mentioned in the Ecclesia, so I don't really ever remember much ever said in my hymn, my experience in the truth, about covetousness. It was just something that people, you know, in the truth thought, well, you shouldn't be covetous, but no one really knew what that meant. So we scarcely know how to define the sin of covetousness or to identify its boundaries. Like, we don't talk about this enough. Would any of us be covetous? Would any of us be more covetous than others? Well, how would we measure it? That's the spirit of it. Like, we really don't know much about this. In biblical times, people often misjudged their relationship to the sin, so that we find records of people who were very covetous and didn't know it, and had to be told that by a prophet or someone sent from God. Why does God look on this sin so severely? Because it's a deadly sin, as you'll see in a couple of quotations in a minute. If God looks on this sin so severely, then maybe we really ought to know a little more about it. And then, to sort of top it all off, this word in the English, covet, is used, and I think it's properly used. If you understand the word covet, you would say it's properly used when the Bible tells us to covet some things, but not to covet others. So it is a talk that's going to take a long time. I thought, first of all, that this word in the English, covetous or covet or coveted or covetousness, could be answered by just finding the Greek word or the Hebrew word and then working from there. But strangely enough, the way the translations come through to us, there's probably four or five words in the Hebrew, and there must be maybe six or seven words, separate Greek, separate Hebrew words, all translated covetousness in English. It's very difficult to put a handle on it by just looking at the words. The word that I thought was the worst word in the Greek to describe covetousness, Jesus used that word in a way that was commendable. So it's difficult, because that's a usual root of how Christadelphians define things, is by looking at the word in the Hebrew and the Greek. The word was, when Jesus came to the Last Supper, he said, "With desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you." Which could have otherwise been translated, "With covetousness, I've coveted this opportunity to eat this feast with you." Because the word there, desire, is a very strong word, but Jesus used it in a good sense. Now, it's sometimes when we get to a little bit of a tangle like this that you just sort of give up on it. Well, no, we shouldn't give up on it, and this is why. Covetousness is deceitful, and it's deadly. It's deadly in the sense of this verse. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9, "Know you not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Be not deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God." Now, you know, you read through the list and you often just associate, you know, fornicators, idolaters, oh yeah, you agree right away that they shouldn't be in the kingdom of God, but you can miss this covetousness one. It's quite down on the list. You can maybe see all the others are, there's good reasons, but why is a covetous person not going to be in God's kingdom? Why does he exclude them from eternal life? And it wasn't until an airplane crash in Washington that I understood what this was all about. Strangely enough, really strangely enough, you may remember the airplane that was taking off. It was in January. Air Florida flight was going down to Florida, and it took off in a snowstorm. And the pilot and co-pilot talked, and you know, about whether they should be de-iced. And eventually, they got on the runway, and this was going to take a long time to go back and get de-iced. So they just made out that it was all okay, and they took off, and immediately got into trouble. Got to the point where they had to either abort the takeoff or take off, and they even stumbled that over because they tried to take off, and they didn't succeed in taking off. The airplane came in, hit a bridge, and went into the Potomac River, and it was kind of noted for the fact that some people got out and were helping others get out, but eventually no one else could escape the cold waters. Now, the reason I say I thought of that and this was because I read about this in a magazine before I really knew much about it. And the magazine, I even forget the name of this now, but it was a magazine that was trying to explain how that the pilots had a problem with evolution. That their brains hadn't really evolved enough to get over this problem of self-deception. They were deceived, they were. Because they looked out, they described in the cockpit voice recorder that they had a little bit of snow on the wing, and the other one said, well, I got about a half an inch of snow on the wing. They couldn't have taken off. They knew they couldn't take off of that. They took off anyway. Doesn't do much for your confidence in the pilot. But that's the way it happened. And when they took off, apparently there was enough ice in the little controls on the wings that measure the speed of the aircraft to get an indirect or a false reading, and hence it didn't have enough speed to take off, but didn't know it. So this idea of self-deception, I thought, you know, that the Bible speaks of this somewhere, self-deception, and that's where you come to be not deceived. Now, why would God say that? Or, you know, the Apostle Paul, through the inspiration of God, say that. Be not deceived. That's a whole other side of this. The chances are we will be deceived by this. That somehow or other, we will think it's okay when it isn't. It's like a person who has stood up against divorce and remarriage very strongly in his life. And then one of his children become divorced, and all of a sudden it's not so bad anymore. And everyone else can see this, but the person is self-deceived and can't see it. That's the spirit of being self-deceived. Well, that really eliminates this topic of covetousness, because it suggests that we can be deceived in this. We can think it's okay when it's not okay. And that's a study in itself. Now, here's a little example of how we can be deceived. You know, that's a pretty well-used target. And I don't know how you'd feel about it, but if you look at the numbers, there must be a number 1 further out. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's a 9 and there's a 10. So that the idea of a 10 is really the only one that counts here, even though there are others in the yellow circle. So I suppose you get, you know, some credit for being in yellow, some credit for being in red, some for being in blue, and then even some credit for the other ones. A lot of people get through life like that. I remember coming into teaching a student who told me when I marked him, that he had found fault with my marking scheme. And I said, well, you know, what's wrong? And he says, well, he didn't give me any part marks. Well, I said, well, you didn't get the answer right. Well, I didn't get the answer right, but you should have given me part marks. Well, why would I give you part marks? Well, I put something down. He says, I would never have got this far in life if it hadn't been for part marks. And I thought, you know, maybe some people actually do think that that's the way to go through life. But to sin is to miss the mark. The only one that counts here is 10. Everything else missed the mark. Sin is disobedience. Everything else but obedience misses the mark. If we give heart marks for someone who says, well, I nearly obeyed, or I partially obeyed. You can see how silly it is. Well, maybe how deadly it is. But that's the way we can be deceived into thinking that as long as we made an effort, that's okay in God's sight. No, it isn't okay. God did not judge us that way. If you have a look at Exodus chapter 20, you just see this is what God recorded. It was his finger that wrote this on stone. And he says clearly here in verse 17, Exodus 20, thou shalt not covet. And God, being God, with the wisdom that he had, knowing this was for human consumption, says, if you want some parameters on this, you shouldn't covet your neighbor's house. You shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor any other thing that is thy neighbor's. But God, understanding our human inability sometimes to see where it applies, because it's not open-ended. It's not that, you know, you can just make up your own mind as to what you should or shouldn't covet. God specified it. And when we think of those things, yeah, I can remember that house. You know, I was always attracted by that house. I actually would have liked that house rather than the one I'm in. And that's the way it is sometimes. That's what draws us to do things which God hates. It's because he will tell us in the New Testament, many, many years later, to be content with what we have and not be led by this constant wanting something more or something better. So there we are. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, his manservant or his maidservant, his house or his ox, his ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's. Picked up again in the New Testament in Romans 13, verse 9. For this thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. If there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So it's not as if, well, the Ten Commandments are over. Like, we're not following the Ten Commandments, we're following the New Testament law. Well, there it is in the New Testament. We should not covet. So you can see, brethren and sisters and young people, I hope we can see that there's a dilemma here for us. Why would we not want to know very well what God meant here when we see it could exclude us from the kingdom? In fact, there would be good reasons for us to go through all of those acts of behavior in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 to make sure we understand what it means when it says those words. Some of those words we just think, oh, I think I know what that means. But you wouldn't just pass off some of the things in life so easily if it was really important to you just to say, well, I think I know the way to go somewhere, or I think I'm on the right aircraft, or I think I've got the right day or the right time. All these things are really meaningful to us and important to us. And this must be just as much so. Now you think of this, as I really can't do too much in the time we have here, but I can give you a little taste of this, because I really think if you get a taste of this, you will want to just investigate this a little more yourself. It says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 6 and 7, now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So we know what the example means. It's the exact thing that God's trying to point out. That's an example. Not just, you know, any old example. No, it's the exact thing. That's the word tupos. It means a die, something that's stamped on. It's the exact impression of the die. That's the idea behind examples. And lust after is a word that's used for coveting. It's a craver. I crave it. I want it. Like, we wouldn't normally use that word, though maybe you do use that word craving. We don't at home. It's not a word. I think most of us would understand what it means. But to crave something is to really want something, is to wish for it, is to seek it out. That's the idea of craving. Well, we shouldn't crave evil things as they also lusted. Now, we go a little bit further into this, and we find that in Numbers 11, verse 4, it was the mixed multitude. Like, we're told that. It wasn't just the multitude, like any part of the multitude. It was the mixed multitude that was among them that fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who shall give us flesh to eat?" Now, lusting is another word, different word again, often used in the Old Testament. It's a longing, a delight. Oh, I love to do that. I want to do that. I want to get involved in those things. And obviously, these people could remember it from Egypt. Now, this is where it gets interesting and valuable for us to note. It says, these mixed multitude people remembered the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. And our soul is dried away. There's nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes. So the problem occurs when our memory recalls a time period in our life more appealing to the flesh. Now that should put off a lot of red lights in our mind. We have left the flesh. We made a conscious decision to leave the thinking of the flesh when we were baptized. To be laying in your bed at night or in the morning or whenever else, you can think about things and you meditate about things and you think about, oh boy, I wonder what it would have been like if I had just stayed where I was. Wonder what it would have been like if I had stayed with that job, stayed with that house, stayed with that woman, or whatever it may be that one thinks of. This was the downfalling of people to do that, when it was appealing to the flesh. So it must be a difficult problem for those to come to the truth from a life of sin. Like, we've got to be sensitive. You have these seminars, we have these seminars. And we find people from all over the place get sort of caught in the net. And we look at the fish that are in the net. Some are good and some are bad. But that net came from the Gentiles. It came from all the things that are out there. And hence all these people might come to us and they might confess they don't want to be out there anymore. They want to be with us. But they can't cut off the memory of the flesh that easy. And if they're thinking in their beds, as we may be like them, thinking about things we would rather do or maybe could have done, just sneak a little, you know, trip back to the way it was. Look at what the Bible has to say about that. And there's another point I want to mention here, but I just want to go on to this passage first, because this is really a significant passage. Hebrews 11, one of the ones in covetousness you want to really underline. In verses 14 and 15, it says, "They that say such things declare plainly they seek a country." That's us. We're seeking for a country to come. "And truly, if they or us had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned." You keep thinking about it. You keep going back in your past to what you've left behind. You might just have an opportunity to return. And the opportunity may come as a surprise, but a surprise you were actually looking for, you were waiting for. And so even though you are declaring that you seek a country to come, in your mind, you can be coveting what you left behind because you willingly think about what you left behind. Now, how would we deal with that? Well, the way we would deal with that is when a thought comes into our mind about the way it was, is to say no. Now, I don't know that anybody really does this very much, but I found this fairly effective. It's when a thought enters your mind, which you say, "I don't want to think about that thought," to say no to yourself. Like, it wouldn't really be unusual for you to say it in public today. They just think you're talking to somebody. Just say no. And if your thought's still there, say no again. And finally, it seems like, you know, you're exerting a will against what's happening in your mind. And the thought goes away for a while. Well, you sit there and think about it, and it gets deeper and deeper. And you might even have an opportunity to go back. And who could resist that kind of temptation when you've been almost planning it in your mind by the fact that you have willfully allowed yourself to think of it? That's covetousness. That's unlawful desire. That's the wishing to have things which God would... Well, you yourself, I myself, have said at one time in our life, we don't want that anymore. Because now we're going to walk towards a country that God is making for us. It's subtle. No wonder he said, be not deceived. You really sometimes have to sit and think about how we reason as ourselves. So it's a verse of great wisdom for those who know the battlefield of covetousness. One has to purposely try not to meditate on the past, especially on a lifestyle that we chose to leave behind. Now I just want to go back to this one. There's one little bullet there I missed, and it's too important to miss. Our second bullet says, this must be a difficult problem for those who come to the truth from a life of sin. So when an older person comes into the truth, we might just think that they've come in with all kinds of baggage in their mind and need maybe some special attention and special help not to be visiting it, not to be thinking about it. But our children need protection from having a first-time experience. And the world wants people to have a first-time experience. They want our children to have a first-time experience and all the things that God says are wrong and you won't be in the kingdom for, because that's the way they have an approach to life. If your son had never been to a ball game before, he'd never been in a big stadium, never seen the team come out and the wave go around the stadium and everybody cheering, never had that experience, do you think that he'll be different after having the experience? Do you think he'd ever be able to forget it? Do you think that maybe it would be something he'd want to do again, even though he couldn't go with you? Like, that's the kind of things. It's just a thing I chose to speak on. I haven't really got anything particularly against that, except that, yeah, it could be something that a person starts into and gets to like, or gets to remember. Every one of us must, I think, have had the experience. You're sitting in the memorial meeting and you're listening to the exhortation, or you're about to partake of the bread or the wine, and your mind's on what you saw on TV last night. Your mind's still in the stadium watching the game, how it could have turned out differently if someone had just did something different. That's our mind. That's the thing we want to turn off. We want to develop an ability to turn that off. But it can't be that way if we keep building in experiences which are something that the flesh covets and wants and is able to go back to from time to time to make it even worse. Now, in the goodness of God, in Numbers 11, verse 31, we know that God brought the quails from the sea. So these people were coveting, they wanted meat, they wanted these things, he brought the quails. He let them fall in the camp, as it was a day's journey on this side, and it were a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp. And about 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. So all of a sudden, the whole camp's invaded with these birds. And it must have been something wonderful to them. They had never seen anything like since they left Egypt. Now, you can't fault God for his abundance. It is absolutely amazing as to how much God gives us in return for our little effort. We had the pleasure of growing some sunflowers, putting one seed in the ground, and seeing a sunflower come up, one of those big Russian sunflowers, with a huge head, 1,000 seeds, or one seed in the ground. That's God's abundance. That's what he gives us all the time. We're going to be thankful. We want to be really appreciative for the bounty that God gives us. Not that tomorrow's Thanksgiving in Canada, but that's just, you know, part of our daily life, that we should be thankful for what God has given us. But this was greed. This was well above and beyond anything that was normal. It says the people stood up all that day and all that night and all the next day and gathered the quails. He that gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of Yahweh was kindled against the people, and Yahweh smote the people with a very great plague. Well, you don't get it by just reading 10 homers. What is 10 homers? Now, I make that to be the equivalent of about 220 liters, which would be about in excess of 2 cubic meters. A homer would be. So 10 homers would be 2,200 liters. So that's where I got the 2 cubits from. So that's how much these people gathered. If you think of what a freezer, a whole freezer, would contain. And what do you think that means? Like, how would that be equivalent to greed? How would you think God would reason through that? That was a demonstration of greed. Because it looks like, if you don't be careful with this reading, you're saying, well, there God put this sort of the bait in front of them. And when they took the bait, he killed them for it. Now, there's no mention of anybody being thankful in this. And the suggestion was that they were driven by disbelief. God would never do this again. Hey, this is a one-time venture. God doesn't do miracles like this every day. It happens once, even though they were getting the manna every day. And so they were going to take every bit they could, just in case God never did this again. That's not thankfulness. That's not recognizing the abundant blessing that God gives us, brothers and sisters. That's part of the deceitful way that we look at life at times. We're just, the human beings are just not constituted well to think spiritual ideas. We certainly have a bent for evil. So covetousness, it's first of all missing the mark of obedience for which there are no part marks. You either hit the 10 or you don't get anything. You can't be partly obedient. You're obedient or you're disobedient. There's two aspects to it. There's the thought and then there's the act. Like, you can be just as bad because of your thoughts as you can be of your act. It can be based on old memories. It can be associated with self-pity and weeping, even over things that you have or don't have to eat. It's harder for older converts with a background of sin to deal with this issue because their memory is so chock full of it. We must be careful that what we lead our children into, lest we start in them, our craving for something that isn't right. Covetousness is rooted in unbelief. You don't believe in God. It's associated with greed. And it's often found with an unthankful attitude. It's deadly. As is the case with Ananias and Sapphira, an example I really don't have the time to deal with this morning. I'd just like to deal with this last thought. That hymn was bang on. That was a wonderful hymn. The words in that were just exactly what is expressed in this verse, or these two verses here. He says, let your conversation be without covetousness. And be content with such things as you have, for he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear what man shall do unto me. Now that can't be understood immediately. It's something you have to think about. You have to contemplate. You have to, maybe even in a conversation with other people where you can sort of just bang off ideas from people, like, what do you think this means? Let's just spend 10 or 15 minutes on it. You tell me what you think and I'll tell you what I think, and then we'll take what we've said and we'll try to go a little further with it. Well, this word of covetousness is a word coming from two words, which means fond of silver. It's a person who loves money. And of course, money is the way that it's a route to go to all kinds of evils. If you've got money, then you can exchange it for whatever your heart desires. That's the one of the ways in which it is a route. But God has said he will never fail thee. Now look at this. This is not often used in Scripture, that expression. So that in Joshua chapter 1, verse 1, we find it there, that after the death of Moses, the servant of Yahweh, it came to pass that Yahweh spake unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, there shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Now those weren't idle words that God was saying to Joshua. Those were words meant to encourage, to sustain, to provoke him to right action. You remember that Joshua was privy to the fact that Israel would depart from serving God after Moses died, because Moses had that revealed to him by God, and Joshua was aware of it. You can well understand how Joshua would have been thinking that, you know, Moses, and all the things he did, he failed once. When he went up, instead of speaking to the rock, he struck it. And for striking the rock, he did not go into the promised land at that time. You don't fool with God. Like, there's no ways in which you can say, well, I got part of it right, or I did part of what you wanted to me. Now, God, when he says this, he expects action and belief. And not to do anything is to disbelieve God. It's call him a liar. He said to Joshua, I'll not fail thee or forsake thee. So when he went up against these cities and these people, of which the spies came back and said, how will we ever take on those cities? They're walled up to heaven, so to speak. The people are huge. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. We'll never be able to do this. God was saying, but I'm telling you, Joshua, I am telling you, I will not fail thee or forsake thee. That was his lifeline. That was his tether. He had to believe that God would never fail him nor forsake him. Now you see, it's one thing for us in a comfortable setting to think of this, but just think of yesterday when, you know, things were kind of restless. What did you think then about these things? Did it ever occur to us in the spur of the moment when times get rough to ever think that God has said, I will not fail thee nor forsake thee? These are special words. Now it occurs again. It occurs in 1 Chronicles 28 verse 20. And David said to Solomon his son, be strong and of a good courage, do it. Fear not, nor be dismayed. For Yahweh God, even my God, will be with thee. He will not fail thee nor forsake thee until thou hast finished all the work for the service of the house of Yahweh. And you just can understand a little bit of what it must have been for Solomon, this young man, to look at the huge amount of responsibility on his shoulders. The huge storehouses of the wealth that David had, of the gold and the silver and the brass and the iron and the wood. And the helpers that are specially skilled in it. And the hundreds of thousands of laborers are going to come and they're going to hew stone. But there's one man needed to make this happen. You're it, Solomon. God will never fail thee, nor forsake thee. That word, that expression, was given at really interesting and difficult times for both Joshua and Solomon. So isn't it interesting? We find it here. Let your behavior be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Why would God say that to you and me if he didn't understand this is a major battle for you and I? This can determine whether or not we're in the kingdom. Do we ever think about that when we go out in public to buy something or to, you know, change the way of our life or to develop a different lifestyle or to wish we had, you know, more of this or more of that? It's just to think. Be content with what you have. Because God has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. You can see this is a deep subject. It's got really strong roots in the things that God said to people at a very important times. And I just think that, you know, we need to spend a special time on the idea that this is deceit. I don't really want to do much on this because we've got to move on with what 1 minute left. Deuteronomy 7 verse 25 illustrates a little more of what God meant and how we can be deceitful in this. So you can imagine when they went in to take these graven images of the gods of the land and they burned them with fire. But God could see, someone will say, hey, look, you know, what's that? I don't want the idol. I don't want this in my house, but maybe we could dismantle it. And look at what we could do with the gold. Look at what we could do with the precious stones and the silver this idol's made of. And we could give it to God. Thou shalt not desire the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it unto thee, lest thou be snared therein. It's an abomination unto Yahweh your God. To see God's view of this is to understand the deceitfulness of our nature, which is naturally there. So he says in the follow-up verse, you will not bring an abomination to your house, lest you be a cursed thing like it, but you shall utterly detest it. Thou shalt utterly abhor it. It's a cursed thing. Now, we don't even use that word, hate or detest, very much, but that's the kind of language it really needs to be used when something that God hates comes into our life. We've got to learn to hate it. So I just want to go into the summary here. Covetousness attacks our faith in God. It covers up the need for God and his wish that we be content with what we have. It shows a contempt for his word and guarantee of support. It is deceitful to the point we can hardly recognize it for what it is. It can work alongside our instruction in the Lord and finally undo all the good that instruction has accomplished. It can cause us to be rejected at the judgment seat of Christ. It's deadly. Deadly sin. I only wish we had more time to develop the other aspects of this subject, brothers and sisters, but if you've just seen a little bit that we presented this morning, you might spend a little more time on this whole subject area and see the other things that can help us to deal with what God sees to be deadly and which will, if we don't deal with it, certainly exclude us from the kingdom of God. Thank you.